all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We have a really interesting topic for our interview today. We're pleased to have with us George J. Phillips. George is not only a Marine and currently the Chief Operating Officer of the American Defense International, which is located in Washington, D.C. Some of you may recognize the twang in his voice when we start talking, and you'll know he's from Brooklyn, New York. George, welcome to Veterans Radio.
All right, thank you very much for inviting me on.
Well, you've been serving your country for a long time. Why don't you give us a little thumbnail of your time in the Marine Corps and your post-service business activity, which has a long history now.
Okay. Well, in 1966, in June, I joined the Marine Corps, went to as an enlisted infantryman. I went to, like everybody else, Parris Island, Camp Lejeune, and staging battalion at Camp Pendleton, and went in country in December 1966 to Mike 3-5. And I went on, you know, plenty of operations, combat operations, and that's what brought me in contact with Father Capodanno. In August of 67, he was assigned to our unit, and so I was with him, the day that he was killed.
Well, our topic today really is just that, and that is to talk about Father Vincent Capodanno, who served both as a Roman Catholic priest and served in the as a Navy chaplain. George, tell our Veteran Radio listeners a little bit about Father Capodanno's background before that eventful day in September of 1967.
Sure. Bio is basically he was born on 13 February 29 in Staten Island, New York. He attended St. Michael's Parish in Mariners Harbor there. He was a devout Catholic family. He attended daily mass all the way through his time in Fordham. Went to grammar school there, Curtis High School, 43 to 47, and then attended Fordham University. And it was while he was at Fordham University, coming from Staten Island, back in those days there was no Verrazano, you took the ferries. So he would ride the ferry over, and there was always, as there are now, free booklets on there to read. And there was a booklet on there called Fields Afar, which was published by the Marian Old Missionaries. And it discussed the ongoing work of the Marian Olds and basically current events, what they were doing in China, what they were doing in other places around the world. And that's when Father Vincent began to discern that he had a vocation. Spent 2 years there at Fordham, and then he was accepted into Marino. On 14 June 1958, he was ordained by Francis Cardinal Spellman. 9 years later, Francis Cardinal Spellman would be present at his funeral, which is a little ironic.
And Father Capodanno's assignments took him out of the country to Taiwan and Hong Kong, I guess.
Yeah, he did. After he was ordained, he went to Taiwan, and he served the Hakka people, which were in northern Taiwan, very remote, and his job there was to train young men to prepare for the national tests so that they could move on to higher education. I'll be quite honest, he was there. You know, like all of us, there's things we do well, things we do poorly. He had trouble with language. And the Haku language is, I'm told, one of the most difficult in the world. But he worked at it for 4 years. But eventually his superiors decided, you know, he couldn't, he was very frustrated because he knew his language, inabilities were affecting the quality of the work that he wanted to do. His, superiors, felt the same way and moved him to Hong Kong. But Father Capitano didn't want to go. He wanted to stay with the Haku people and continue to work. I mean, they have a chapel up there dedicated to him as we, you know, today.
Well, it's interesting he gets these assignments to the Far East, if you will. And then in December of 1965, gets commissioned as a lieutenant in the Navy Chaplain Corps. Do we know of the transition for him to say, geez, I think I want to become a military chaplain?
Well, he when they moved him to Hong Kong, where, you know, pretty much everybody to this day speaks English, you know, he was not happy. And so, and the war in Vietnam was beginning to really spin up, especially for the Marine Corps. In May of 65, they landed in Vietnam for the first time, and things began to heat up almost immediately. And Father wasn't happy where he was, and he thought that right now, that at that point in time, the place for him was to serve as a Navy chaplain with the Marines in Vietnam.
Was there a family background of military service, George? And listeners, we're talking to George Phillips, a Marine who served with Father Vincent Capodanno in Vietnam. And it's, you know, oftentimes, George, when we're talking to people on Veterans Radio, their military service is sort of an extension of a family affair. So I'm wondering what if there was something like that in his background.
You know, in Staten Island, you know, especially Italians and all other denominations. But back in those years, up through the mid-60s, it was kind of expected that everybody would, remember the draft was there, and everybody would partake. And that, you know, when he was young, they had World War One veterans there, and then, you know, later on, Korean veterans. I believe his brother Jim, his oldest brother, who died about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, he was a veteran. And so he, growing up, would, without a doubt, have been surrounded with families, with the parent, the fathers in particular, being veterans. And there's also a tremendous sense back then, and back now for even today for a lot of people, a great sense of loyalty to the country and the need to contribute. I mean, if you become a Maryknoll missionary and going to places like Taiwan and other and the other places they went all around the world, I mean, they were losing missionaries to martyrdom over there, you know, several times a year. So it, you know, I think this is dedication to, the values that many of us have, and a loyalty to the country and a loyalty to God and his faith that, first made him a priest and ultimately, made him, come to understand that God's place for him was in Vietnam, not Hong Kong.
And George, can you tell us a little bit about Father Vincent Capodanno when you first met him, when he first got to the unit?
Well, let me give you just a little prelude to that, okay? The when he went in country in 65. You know, when he was commissioned, he went in country in April 66, Holy Week. And Father Cappadonna wasn't there more than 6 months. And we started hearing about this this priest they called the Grand Padre. You know, it was not, well, one, it was not policy, and two, you rarely saw chaplains going out on patrol. Usually they stayed in the headquarters, which is where the policy said they should be. But we started hearing stories, you know, when you would, all the units would go, say, to Da Nang for a 3-day, R&R. And so you would sit around on Hill 327 and you'd meet people, Marines from all over the Vietnam. And so you sit and talk. And this father, that's when I first heard of Father Cappadonna. And then Stars and Stripes published a few articles on him. So by the time he came to us in, August of 67, everybody, especially the Catholics, had heard of the Grand Padre. And, I first met him, going to Mass. And then he would stay and, you know, talk to folks. I talked to him probably on, 6 or 8 occasions, Mass several times, confession. Although confession over there was great. They didn't have a lot of time, so it was all general absolution.
Cleared everything up.
Yeah, I mean, you get a couple hundred guys in 10 seconds, you know.
So let, for our listeners who may be a little younger than you are and younger than I am, talk a little bit about this name, the Grand Padre, that was put on.
Yeah, the Marine infantry guys are called grunts, primarily because they walk every place, which today they tend to ride more. But, you know, they're the kind of the dogs of war for the Marine Corps, and everybody else is in a supporting role. Artillery, fixed wing, helicopters, Amtraks, all the other branches of the Marine Corps, and all the other different jobs in the Marine Corps basically support the Marine infantry, the Marine riflemen. And so for 100 years, they've been called grunts. So when he started doing what the infantrymen do, which is go on patrol, get in firefights, you know, go into, you know, harm's way, that's when he became the Grand Padre, because he was no longer just another chaplain.
In that going out on patrol and getting in firefights, he's not carrying a weapon in this, is he?
Usually not. You know, he didn't like them. You know, the thing with the chaplains and even some of the corpsmen, the policy would change where you have to carry one, you don't have to carry one. I don't think I ever saw him carrying a pistol. You know, he would never carry a rifle. Never really carried a pistol that I can recall. That doesn't mean he didn't. And he was a combat guy. I mean, when he started out in 7th Marines before he came to 5th Marines, and he got a Bronze Star with the Combat V. You know, I don't think I've ever seen one of those on a chaplain.
So he's in country for about a year and a half.
Right.
And
then he extends.
Tell us what you know of that period for him in country.
He was in 7th Marines, 1-7, went on. We were all up north, 1-7, 3-5. And we actually went on some ops together. You know, we have different operations, you know, Union 1, Union 2, DeSoto, you know, all the names are in the history books. But 1-7, was a unit that, kind of like Mike 3-5, always getting in trouble. And he was right there in the middle of it. towards the end of his first year, which was typical of anybody who was going to extend, they would put them on 30 days leave. And he came back to the States, met with his family. The Guild, we have a lot of his writings and testimony to people who talked to him at that time. And it was very clear to all those folks how comfortable he was at this point in his life and how happy he was to be doing this mission. But then he comes back into Vietnam, and he goes to 1st Medical Battalion, which is... other than in the field, that was the triage facility, and also, small hospital. But if people were bad, they got sent, either to the hospital ships or onto other Japan or Okinawa for treatment. And he was there, working with the Marines and sailors that were there. There are a lot of corpsmen assigned to hospitals, and he worked very closely with the corpsmen. And then came a point in time when he was actually August of 67 when he was transferred to 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines.
About a month later, on September 4th of 1967, while Operation Swift is ongoing, and why don't you walk us through what happens that day?
Okay. It actually starts on September 3rd. Back here in the U.S., it was Labor Day weekend. We didn't really celebrate those things in Vietnam. But 1-5, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, Alpha Company, was out on patrol, they got into a very heavy firefight. A lot of injuries, a lot of people killed. And so, as the firefight, continued through the night, it became clear to the command elements that this was more than just a brief encounter with, Viet Cong. That these were probably NVA regulars. So Mike 3-5 that day was, what we used to call Sparrowhawk. Actually, I think they still use the term. Sparrowhawk is just a unit that has to be ready to go within 4 hours in case somebody gets in trouble. Well, at midnight, Alpha Company, there was very little left of it. And so they decided, and now they knew they were NVA. So we get ready to go. Father Capodanno goes up and gets all the briefings, just like the company commanders, platoon sergeants. And he gets all the briefings, and he gets told by the company commander, J.D. Murray, don't be getting on any helicopters. And so he doesn't, I'm sure J.D. would tell you the story. He didn't say, he just kind of looked at him and said, I'll be where I have to be. As the night progressed, we got our marching orders about where to go and what we were likely to see, which was, not going to be good. So we go down to the LZ. And who's down in the LZ but Father Capodanno? And he's got all his gear with him. But he had set it off to the side. And I saw him, talked to him several times down in the LZ. He always had two things that he carried with him. Cigarettes. He was like a cigarette machine. He smoked like a cigarette machine. And he always had cigarettes for, I don't know, if there was 10 or 50 people there, he always had cigarettes for him. He also had St. Christopher medals, which was St. Christopher was the and still is the protector of travelers. He would hand the St. Christopher medals out, and he was doing that down at the LZ. Eventually, the helicopters come, and there are there's a dozen stories, you know, that could go, but because we only have a limited amount of time. You know, the helicopters come. I was in first platoon. We go out. Second platoon goes out. Third platoon goes out. And, you know, of course, who gets on the very last helicopter when there's nobody left in the LZ to tell him he can't go is Father Capodanno. So I'll jump forward now several hours. We landed. They put us down about 1,000 kilometers from where we needed to be, so we all start, you know, what we call movement to contact. We come up over, a first platoon comes up over what we now call the Knoll, which is a small hill, and we're going down the front of it, and the point man yells back to, and I could tell you all the names, but my memory is sometimes not perfect, and says, "I think I just saw a bush move." And Sergeant Sullivan yells back, "Well, if it moves again, shoot it." And about 30 seconds later, you hear about 10 rounds fired off, and then the whole world opened up. First and second platoon, we were out on the front slope. Second platoon had moved up on top and along the sides. And we were engaged not only with rifle fire, but with 7.62 machine guns, 50 cal machine guns, mortars up to 120.
This firefight went on for quite a
while.
This
went on for, it went on through the night in varying degrees.
During this time, and I'm going to move us along because of time, as you say, Father Campodano's going among the wounded and the dying, giving last rites, giving counsel, and unfortunately, you know, finding himself being one of the folks who gets injured and ultimately killed.
Yes, late in the afternoon, after a day, you know, this started early afternoon, and as you said, Father Campodano was up and down the hill, and I could tell you again, for time I won't, but I'll just. So as it was getting dusk, late in the afternoon, there was a corpsman treating a Marine about halfway down the hill. Father Campodanno saw them and also saw a 50 cal machine gun moving up and being put in place. So he went down, ran down the hill to try to get them back. When he couldn't, he threw his body over them and immediately took 26 50 cal shots. He had already been wounded earlier that day twice and you know, just took care of himself. His right arm didn't work, but he was killed then.
Listeners, this is a man who could have stayed in the safety of the company command post and in some regards was told to and refused medical aid through this firefight so that he could continue to serve, as his Medal of Honor citation notes. George, you were there that day when Father Campodanno's body was recovered.
Right.
Did the men with you and with him know that this guy was extraordinary?
Everybody did. And I will tell you that had you met him, the first thing that you would see, and the first thing that you would realize is that everything was in his eyes. His eyes just were so full of compassion and so full of caring and so full of God's love that it was impossible not to feel that this is a special man that you're talking to. And when he was talking to somebody, it didn't matter what was going on all around him. He would focus generally on one person at a time. And for those of us that had that experience, when you talked to him, you felt like there was nothing else going on. He had such a calming effect when he was treating the dying Marines and the wounded. He always said to them, and he would tell us before we left, God is with us all this day. And he would repeat that over and over again to whoever he talked to.
I want our listeners, as we wrap up here, to realize that Father Campodanno's selfless acts have been recognized by the country in a Medal of Honor. He has been advanced for canonization within the Catholic Church. George Phillips, who we're talking to, is the president or chair of the Father Vincent Campodanno Guild. George, how do people continue to follow the ongoing story of this incredible chaplain?
There is we have a website. It's CampodannoGuild.org. And we also publish newsletters, to people who contribute, because that's the only way we get their names, although you could sign up for the newsletter on the website. And it's a pretty good website. There's a lot of history in there. There are pictures. Some of the information that we've gathered to support the cause for canonization. But if you wanted to keep up with it, or if you want to become just more familiar than we can over, a short phone conversation, it's all up on, the website again, CampodannoGuild.org.
It's important for our listeners to, I think, know this story, just like it's important for them to know of the four chaplains from World War II or Father Emile Campano from Korea.
Right.
These are all inspiring men who bring out and shine the best in all of us. This is also a story that you hope to bring to TV and film here. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, George?
Yeah. The Guild's mission is twofold. One, of course, to raise funds to pay for all the efforts that have to take place. But the other part of the responsibility, and equally important, is to spread information about this servant of God, Father Vincent Campodanno, as broadly as we can to as many audiences as we can, not only Catholic, but non-Catholic alike. And we decided back in March or February that, there's an old EWTN clip, runs about an hour, 45 minutes, but it's old, it's not up to date, there were some errors, there's still things in there that are not true. So anyway, we decided to put together a documentary, and we were able to convince EWTN, which is the Eternal Word Television Network, founded by Mother Angelica, and they became our partners in this. And so we have been working on that. We intend to go to Vietnam shortly, back to the Knoll, where Father Campodanno was killed. We're bringing back, three or four, Marines who were there that day, plus a film crew.
We certainly want our listeners on Veterans Radio to learn more about this story. Go to CampodannoGuild.org. Look for the Grunt Padre, Servant of God, story that should be coming out in the near future by EWTN. And pass this story along. As I say, it's inspirational on so many different fronts, whether you are religious or not. This is stories about a man who sacrificed himself for his fellow men. So it's a great inspirational story. George, I want to thank you for making time available today to talk to our listeners. Thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcast and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
2 years ago, I became pregnant with a baby I desperately wanted. During a routine ultrasound, I learned that the fetus would have a fatal condition and never survive. I had to flee my own state to receive treatment. I think Donald Trump bears an incredible amount of responsibility for these restrictive laws. We need leaders that will protect our rights, and that's Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
In a perfect world where everyone is a perfect driver.
Please, go ahead and merge. I'll make room.
Thank you, fellow driver.
You wouldn't need a seatbelt. But we don't live in a perfect world. About 1,000 Michiganders die each year in vehicle crashes. Wearing your seatbelt reduces your risk of death in a crash by 45% or more. So make our imperfect world safer. Buckle up. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.